Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
It's the Old Master series, and life must have been at least a little frustrating for our old master on today's show. His name was Walter Weir. He was a very active and successful copywriter and advertising professor, but he must have constantly run into resistance along the way, since so many of his ideas were ahead of their time. Walter Weir was born in 1909 and he died in 1996. He published a couple of books which are nearly impossible to find today. Maybe the publisher, my old employer at McGraw-Hill, took them out of print quickly because the ideas were so far ahead of their time, they didn't sell very well to, you know, people living in the present. I don't know. What I do know is I was fascinated by his ideas. His writing style is a bit literary and academic compared to what we are used to, but he's clear enough, and what he has to say is so valuable, it's definitely worth the effort to understand what he's saying. So we'll dive right in, right after I remind you that copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear in this podcast, and most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims and if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. Walter Weir originally wanted to be a newspaper reporter. I found out this in his obituary in Ad Age from 1996. At the start of his career, Weir had walked into the office of the ad manager instead of the editor's office by mistake at the old newspaper called the Philadelphia Record, where he was looking for a job. According to Weir's son, Tony, the ad manager gave Walter some advice. The man told him that if he wanted to write, Weir should go into an advertising agency where they pay higher salaries. And so he did. The most important part of this is that Walter Weir saw himself not as a reporter, as an ad guy, but as a writer. He thought bigger than someone mentally stuck in any one single category. He had very strong opinions and little patience for compromise and groupthink. As a result, he must have made a lot of enemies because he spoke his mind without hesitation in a business where hesitation is widespread and straightforwardness is in short supply. But he was still enormously successful as an ad guy. In the 1940s, he was head of copy at Lord & Thomas, the same agency the famous old master Claude Hopkins had been president of and then chairman of 20 years earlier. He worked for many other agencies as well. Weir wrote a column, a weekly column, for Ad Age, the magazine, for 25 years called The Creative Man's Corner, but, and this is important, he did so anonymously. He did not seek out the spotlight. Also, after he retired from agency work, he went to teach advertising at the University of Tennessee and Temple University in the 1970s. He clearly cared about teaching others, and some of the things he emphasized in his book, which today, for some reason, are almost completely impossible to find, are way ahead of their time when he wrote them and said them. But they're right up to date today. I wanted to give you a little background on the career of this most unusual old master before we dig into his wisdom.
Okay, from that, I think I like this guy already, but it's a lot, but I have never heard of this guy before.
No, I mean, the only way I heard of him was I saw his name in this book, Cashvertising, by Drew Eric Whitman, and Drew said that Walter Weir was his mentor, and I thought, that's interesting. So I started down the rabbit hole, and it was really hard to find any information about him, but when I did, I was thrilled. So that's the only way I would have known.
All right. Well, let's jump into it.
All right. So first thing, first Walter Weir concept, the most important thing your copy says is what it says about you. Most copywriters approach their work as a simple technical job, find the best way to sell the product. The problem with this approach these days, copy is written that way without the writer leaning in a little to his own personality, is that the copy comes across more and more like something written by AI. And that's something people are learning to automatically flinch at when they see. No good for you, no good for the prospect, and no good for the offer owner themselves. From Walter Weir's obituary in Ad Age. Walter was always a fighter for what he believed in, and he believed in good advertising deeply. He wrote in one of his books, "Your copy, more than you realize, is you, and you are what you believe." In his book, Truth in Advertising, Weir wrote, "Advertising is essentially communication, not a magical incantation. Consequently, the more credible it is, the more likely it is to gain cooperation from the person to whom it is directed. Another quality it must have is clarity, so that understanding is engendered." Somewhat highfalutin language, but the meaning is unmistakable. If you don't believe it, neither will your prospect. If you're not clear on what you're selling, your prospect won't buy. This is actually a modern idea. Last year, marketer Pedro Martins came out with a really interesting book called Stand Out or Fade Away. And the whole premise of his book was this: in today's market, the best offer doesn't win. The best understood one does. Walter Weir understood and espoused truths that the world at large wasn't always ready to hear. But he was courageous enough to say those things anyway. There's a hardcore principle from neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, that goes like this. The meaning of communication is the response you get. What it means is the effectiveness of your communication is measured by the listener's interpretation and response, and not by your intention as the speaker. It puts 100% of the responsibility on the communicator. In his unusual way, this is what Walter Weir wrote in 1962, which is 64 years ago. He wrote, "I cannot emphasize enough or strongly enough that communication exists to the degree that what is said, what is transmitted, becomes a part, a new part, of the person addressed. That means that what is said must be understandable, not in the sense of the words must already be in the reader's or listener's vocabulary, but in the sense that they convey to the reader or listener vividly the proposition that will enlarge him as a human being." I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but what he's saying is, in fact, visionary. It's that the words in your copy matter, and for them to work, they need to have a meaningful effect on your prospect, and that it should be a positive effect. I have a client who spends 9 or 10 figures a year on advertising, and every time we meet, he says a version of the same thing and means it.
I don't have much to add right there. I can see why you say that this guy was ahead of his time, though.
Okay, well, we got a lot more, so let's keep going. He had an extreme position on the truth, unquote, the truth, unquote. Weir was active as an advertising professional for 4 decades, starting in the 1930s and retiring in the 1970s. He was under no illusions about how the deception and manipulation that was part and parcel of how advertising was written and delivered. And he frequently protested against anything but the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. A couple of the many times he protested were in his book called, guess what, Truth in Advertising. He wrote, "A lack in the product cannot possibly be compensated for by a lie in the advertising." And he wrote this, "No matter how we analyze the human or the business situation, we come inevitably to one conclusion, that no one can afford to disregard or offend against truth or human sensibility." Now, it's clear that he was taking a moral position, that it's inherently wrong to lie to your prospect, and if that's what you have to do to sell your product, then you need to find a better product to sell. But there was also a pragmatic financial tone to what he was saying. listen to this passage also from the book Truth in Advertising. The A to S ratio, the advertising to sales ratio, goes up in direct relation to the acceptance of the advertising message. And as one campaign contributes to building resistance to the others, the A to S of all inevitably rises. What he's saying in simple terms is that every time you lie, or even come across as not telling the truth, every time that happens, your next ad has to work harder the next time than it would have had otherwise, just to counter the effects of the ad where the prospect suspected you were lying. So what he's saying is there's a financial cost to not telling the truth. It actually costs you measurable dollars when you don't tell the truth. This has become more and more accepted by at least entrepreneurial copywriters and business owners today in 2026. But Walter Weir was saying it in a book published in 1963, and probably saying it to team members and clients for decades leading up to that time, and probably getting way more pushback than he would have gotten. Once again, living and thinking decades ahead of almost everyone else.
What I love about this is sophisticated markets. As you get older, you've been told a bunch of lies, you've been burned before, you're much more skeptical of each new offer. That being the case back then, amplified today by how many offers people see every day, by social media and scams and frauds that get announced, and people being able to go to Yelp and leave a review, or go to social media or Reddit and complain about your offer. It's 10 times, maybe 100 times more accurate today than it would have been back in 1963 when he wrote this. But again, writing something that was decades ahead of where the rest of the market was at.
For sure. All right, let's go to his next point that I got from going through his books and other writings and things written about him. First of all, copywriters have to be really skilled writers. Our old master, Walter Weir, holds copywriters to a very high standard. This point of view probably wouldn't survive in today's conversion rate optimization world, where people will throw words together like spaghetti against the wall to find something that gets a higher click-through rate, even if those words ring hollow or don't really make much sense put together that way. But ultimately, I think Weir is right, and that the advertisers who win in the long run and continue to exist next year and don't get taken down by regulators are the ones who take the quality of writing seriously. Because these days we know that the best companies have relationships with their customers. Short-term dollars could turn into long-term distrust or even disgust. Why? Because a bunch of AI or CRO-generated mishmash words do not good relationships make, as Robert Frost might say if he were alive today writing poetry. In his book On the Writing of Advertising, Weir comes down pretty hard on people writing who cannot appreciate the value, feeling, sound, and effect of words on the people who read those words. Weir writes, "There are some people, not nearly enough, who humbly insist they cannot write, and that the minute they try, they become pen-tied, the verbal freshet that flows so effortlessly from mind to tongue in conversation and tumbles and spills uninhibited over the lips when the decision is to write instead of talk, becomes somehow dammed up and choked as it is diverted down the arm and collects in quiet pools to stagnate and gather green scum and never reach the fingertips." The world is better for such people and might be better still if their numbers were more legion. Unfortunately, there are as many who refuse to accept their condition and stubbornly force themselves to perform a task for which they are essentially unfitted. The result is a forced kind of writing, writing that lacks spontaneity and ease and friendliness. The words are there, but they remain words. They never coalesce to form meaning and significance. They lack living warmth. They do not vibrate with human feeling and emotion. They remain printer's ink on a page. They never become part of the blood pulsing through the corpus. It is not that the natural writer writes with the same uninhibited facility with which so many people talk. He may brood over his words. He may wait endless minutes for the right word, the most apt word, to emerge from a tiny cave in his mind. He may reject it and go off seeking one that he hopes will be even more pregnant with the quality of illumination and all the right, which all the right words possess. The difference is that he knows what he is after. He senses the nuances in words. He can tell unerringly when they are right. Okay, I know that's a bunch of mouthfuls, but I think it's safe to say that Weir is on Team Talented Writer and not on Team Assembly Line Copy. So it appears that Weir is at odds with Gene Schwartz, who said that copy is assembled and not written. If Weir had been in the room when Schwartz uttered those words, he might have responded, "Not on my watch." A personal note, I've always found the top performing copywriters in every niche pay attention to the nuances and textures of words and sentences. Maybe not as much as a poet or a playwright would, but far more than a wordslinger who's going for speed and volume and efficiency and really couldn't give a shit about quality. One thing to bear in mind on a purely practical note, ultimately, the bigger and more competitive your market is, the more important good writing becomes.
I'm just going to make a note. The type of writing that he was talking about is the majority of what AI has been trained on.
Yep.
The type of copy where it's just words for words' sake, or someone writing because they want to get an idea out there, but they're not a really good writer. 95% of what AI's been trained on is that. So if you don't have an eye to catch that and adjust it and train your bots to not write that way, you're going to get exactly what he was talking about.
Right. And these days, it's more dangerous than ever because people are sensitized to it. They're on the lookout for it, and they really have a negative reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. His next point. Group brainstorming is a terrible way to write copy. So poet and playwright John Haywood came up with the phrase "two heads are better than one" in 1546, as Weir points out in his book On the Writing of Advertising. However, Haywood was not a copywriter whose work was ultimately judged by sales results. And in our world, Weir says, Haywood's famous phrase is just a bad idea. Weir writes, "Accepting the statement without question, and believing as fervently as we do in the superiority of numbers, it was perhaps inevitable that we should eventually reach the assumption that, if two heads are better than one, three must be far better than two, four definitely preferable to three, through simple arithmetical progression, that the multi-headed monster of brainstorming should hold the ultimate answer to advertising's unceasing demand for ever newer and brighter ideas." In the chapter called Two Heads in his book On the Writing of Advertising, Weir ruthlessly takes apart the idea of writing copy by committee. He points out a very thorough Yale University study that studied brainstorming and found the results were inferior compared to individual efforts when the goal was coming up with creative ideas. He also tells of an agency where the art director and the copywriter, when they can't come up with a good concept fast enough, every writer in the agency is assigned the project and asked to come up with an approach, a theme, and a piece of copy. The premise of this policy, he concludes, is, quote, "If enough good ideas are elicited, enough ideas are elicited, one good idea must result and be found." And here's what he says. "I not only cannot subscribe to this philosophy, but I find it repugnant. I think it is obvious that the quality of the ideas thus produced will be no higher than the quality of the mentalities involved in the exercise. If the highest mentality in the group is, for the purpose of argument, grade B, to me, at least, it is obvious that the best ideas produced will be no higher than grade B. The key to great copy is having one person highly qualified and highly capable in charge and making that person fully accountable for coming up with a winning idea. In his highly ornate language, Weir sums it up this way. The vision we call inspiration is never vouchsafed to a group. It is visited solely upon the individual devotedly listening for voices in the silent, ghost-haunted chamber of his single, one and only, never again to be duplicated, someday to be dead and vanished, but nonetheless real and undeniable and history-shaping your mind. Ding! Score one for the individual.
All I can think of is too many cooks in the kitchen.
Absolutely. And, you know, so we recently had Glenn Fisher on, and he's doing Financial Copy U again, along with his partner, and MarketWise. And, I mean, the main thing they work in is teaching individuals to come up with really good ideas. It's a skill. It's not spatter, you know. It's not, you know, detritus. It's not stuff that you come up when you're scatting. Oh, by the way, it takes something. So, anyway, part six, copywriting is a full body experience. Let's circle back to the statement from NLP about the meaning of communication being the response it causes. One of the people who was around way before NLP was founded and popularized was the semantics professor Alfred Korzybski. He wrote a book called Science and Sanity. It was published in 1933, and this book introduced the words neurolinguistics and neurosemantics way before NLP founders Richard Bandler and John Grinder using those terms and basing a lot of their work on Korzybski's work did 40 years later. So, in his book On the Writing of Advertising, our old master, Walter Weir, talks about something Korzybski said in his book that really caught Weir's attention. Weir writes, Korzybski speaks of the effect of words on the nervous system. When I first came upon this statement in Science and Sanity, I could not understand how a lifeless object, such as a printed word, could possibly impinge and cause a reaction on the human nervous system. Yet, over time, Weir came to understand it very well. And he came to the belief that a writer must understand how people feel and otherwise react to words in order to do a good job. He wrote, "The use of a particular word must be weighed in relation to its neurological and physiological effects on the person reading or hearing it. Words are of themselves lifeless. They become part of the life process only as the person to whom they are addressed cooperates in their use, accepts them as meaningful, or even meaningless." His message to copywriters, in short, is this: get out of your head and into your body. Consider how your words will affect your prospect in the most holistic way possible. Here's a longer version of that in Weir's words. A person who writes generally writes for the eyes or the ears or the mind. As Korzybski saw the effects of language, this is a decidedly limited view, and the writer who visualizes such a short course for his words to travel may very well fail to have his words go as far as he wishes. He must constantly bear in mind that before the advertisement he writes can exercise an effect on another person, it must be absorbed by that person. It must not just be read or heard. It must be taken in and made a vital and inseparable part of the whole being. That's a tall order, but it's also a very accurate description of what the best copy does.
I think of all the times where I've been tripping up on a single sentence in my copy, and it just doesn't feel right. And then I switch one word, and all of a sudden it feels right. And I can't explain other than feel. It feels differently. It's a word that would be right next to the original word in the thesaurus. It means the exact same thing, but one word feels right and the other one doesn't.
Okay, so let me throw one of my pet theories at you that I don't think I've really shared on the podcast before.
Let's hear it.
We as copywriters go through life having, we as humans go through life having experiences. And initially we notice them and we interpret them. And then later on we've had enough of them, so we start to catalog them. And then further on still, maybe after many years or many repetitions or many instances, we integrate them into something smaller, more compact, and easier to access. And what that's called is a feeling. That a lot of our feelings, not all of them, not in every situation, but in the situation you're talking about, is simply an organization and a reduction and a filter and even a microprocessor, a human microprocessor that represents a lot of what you know. And so when it has the right feeling, it kind of checks at a subsonic or
subliminal almost.
Subliminal, thank you. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. A subliminal level or speed or awareness that, so it feels right. And you see people in all kinds of fields talking about whether something feels right or not, and they can't explain it. And I think that's why. I think it's simply a combination of accumulated and organized and optimized experience.
It's a shortcut. Your brain doesn't go through all of the reasons. It just says, yep, this feels right.
Yeah, exactly. Shortcut. Boom. Yeah.
All right, let's recap today's episode, man.
All right, so here are five takeaways from what Walter Weir wrote decades ago that is just as true and much more accepted today. One, write copy that you truly believe because people can feel it when you don't. When you don't believe it, your reader won't either, and if your reader doesn't believe it, they won't buy. Two, use words that people can feel as well as merely understand. Forget about clever word plays. Say stuff they can feel in their bones. Mm-hmm. Three, if you've got a group going over the copy, write the copy yourself, by yourself, just you. While a committee can review, only one voice can lead. Mm-hmm. Four, forget about features and benefits. Instead, present a description of something someone would feel good about using. People don't tend to buy just to have something. They tend to buy to feel something. And five, cut everything that doesn't sound like something a real person would actually say. Because unless it sounds like a human, it won't reach one.
I love it. I cannot believe I've gone my entire career without having going down the Walter Weir rabbit hole, man.
Yeah, well, me neither until a few weeks ago. So you're in good company. How's that?
All right. If you enjoyed this episode, we've got a bunch of other Old Master series episodes available over at copywriterspodcast.com. So definitely head on over there and check it out. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later.
Stop using the hero's journey in your sales copy. My book, The Persuasion Story Code, will help you put together stories that convince your prospects and resolve their objections. If you are a copywriter, you'll appreciate that every single one of the 25 kinds of stories in this book have been proven time and time again in profitable sales copy. But I've also used these kinds of stories to close 5- and 6-figure deals for my own business, and so have many of my clients. These stories are easy to create and easy to tell. They sound like ordinary conversation, but they are all designed and proven to lead to a yes. You can get the Persuasion Story Code on Amazon.com. So get your copy today.